Hello, the internet, and welcome to season 44, episode 2 of The Daily Zeitgeist!
Yeah.
For Tuesday, August 14th, 2018, my name's Jack O'Brien, a.k.a. You getting stripped from your garments, boy, rung your jewels. Miles Gray got me open like fallopian tubes, a.k.a. he's pong your head when you least expect. Jack O'Brien on the mic, boy, protect your neck. That was
good lord.
Wu-Tang, a.k.a., and I'm thrilled to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Miles Gray!
All right, Jack, I hope you're ready, because if you come with that Wu-Tang, get ready for...
Let Miles love open the door. Let Miles love open the door. Let Miles love open the door to your heart.
Pete Townsend. All right, thank you, Matt Schlessel, at Mr. Schlessel on Twitter for that, a.k.a.
We don't plan it, but it's just, like, in the firmament that if one of us does, like, a cool song, the other one is going to do, like,
just something
some
soft.
Kinda,
just balance.
Yeah, some soft
rock shit. We're like a purple mattress. We're both soft and firm at the same time.
Whoa.
Wow. Yep. Wow.
And if their ad buy expires, if you're listening to this in the future, we'll scrub this.
Because I'm about to counter you with Ghost Bed.
Oh, really?
Fuck is that?
Wait, first of all, who is that? Who in here? Who there?
They are fine mattresses.
Who there?
We are thrilled to be joined by one of the great gonzo journalists and funniest, smartest dudes I know, Mr. Robert Evans.
I don't have a rap. I'm sorry.
A.K.A. Matt.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, A.K.A. Matt, which is a hard-ass A.K.A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's up, man?
Not much. I was at a Unite the Right 2.0.
I know.
Like a day and a half ago.
Right. Yeah. And on the side of the white supremacist?
Yes. I've been a white supremacist.
Oh. No.
He's taking it down from the inside.
Right.
White Klansman is going to be the name that he's in.
Not quite as good a title.
Yeah.
So...
Unimpressed with their turnout?
Yeah, it's more that I was happy and gratified to see how many people came out to march against them.
Yeah, for sure.
I think the importance of getting 5,000 or however many thousand people to show up to protest Nazis when they march is important for the same reason why you should do pull-ups in the morning. Like, you're not going to need to lift yourself up every day. But every now and then, you'll run into a situation where it's useful to have that kind of strength. And it's protested the same thing. It's like it's building a muscle.
That's like a Chinese proverb or something.
Yeah,
that was wise.
Good,
you don't have to do a pull-up every day, but you might have to pull up with that energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to hear more wise Chinese proverbs from the mouth of Robert Evans. But first, we are going to tell our listeners what they're in store for. We're going to talk about the Manafort trial, where the defense just rested without calling witness.
We call that a mic drop. Legalese, Jack.
We're going to check out some of the highlights from DEF CON, the hacker convention. What were they able to hack? Basically, a lot of
so
terrifying shit.
Anything with internet.
Yeah. We're going to check in with a Politico story about how Trump doesn't understand things like countries and time zones. Just a lot of fun details that aren't really surprising, but just... about as hilarious and embarrassing as you would expect from this White House. We are going to introduce you to Bob Goodlatte's son, Bobby.
Bobby.
And I was pronouncing it as Bob Goodlatte, but that's not right,
no,
is it?
Yeah, it's Goodlatte. Okay. It looks like it.
Probably does not like when it is pronounced like that.
That's probably our way to troll him then.
Yeah. We're going to ask Robert what global conflicts he's keeping an eye on, because he... has always been on top of those since I've known him. We're going to check back in with Omarosa. We are going to look at the weekend box office, wherein The Meg dominated. We are going to have some beverage news, two beverage stories at the end of the episode.
Mm.
But first, Robert, we like to ask our guests, what is something from your search history that is revealing about who you are?
I've been looking a lot at ties between Patriot Prayer, the group that was protesting in Portland 2 weeks ago. They're not a white nationalist group. They don't consider themselves a fascist group. But they have a lot of ties to people who are at Unite the Right. Their leader, Joey Gibson, has a lot of ties to people who were at the first Unite the Right rally. And I'm essentially trying to build a case that a lot of these organizations that claim to be counter to Antifa or counter to communism have their basis in fascist groups and are, in fact, largely peopled by outright fascists. So that's what I'm searching around these days.
You find anything interesting?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of ties between them. And a lot of the strategies that these groups are using sort of began last year with a group called Anticom that was heavily tied with the – they were at Unite the Right. They were a big part of the first Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. Their Discord server was taken down in September, and their Twitter hasn't been very active since. But they pioneered a lot of the strategies that you've seen the Proud Boys using and Patriot Prayer using to success in Berkeley.
Yeah, it sounds like they – both Anticom, you said?
Anticom was the name of the first group. But they were the first – they were
– I thought you were talking about Proud Boys, not jerking off. Sorry.
Well,
bad,
no.
Bad
that's,
joke.
They're
bad
Anticom.
Joke.
No, that's a great joke, Jack. I just didn't catch it at first.
But, dude, Anticom would be a cool shirt, actually. It looks like a logo.
It is better than
group.
NoFap, right. Which is what they call it.
Yeah.
Patriot Prayer is a group that, if you were paying attention to the right-wing media in the past couple months, mm-hmm. you would see headlines about how, you know, different people were protesting a religious group.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's very shady. They have some connections to, like, their agenda doesn't totally make sense, and it seems like they have a lot of connections to some of the shadier far-right groups.
Starting almost, you know, 7 or 8 months before the first Unite the Right rally, so the guys in the Anticom chat room, who were also members of groups like the Traditional Workers Party, there's a lot of bleed in between mm-hmm. these groups. There's a lot of interchange between them.
Traditional workers, I mean, I can't argue with that. What's wrong? that sounds good.
That doesn't sound like
almost
a Nazi
like
group.
National Socialist. Yeah,
just like Patriot Prayer. Those words. Right. I like Patriot. I like prayer.
Yeah, those are both good things.
Yeah, they're basically born out of the realization that defining yourself as white nationalist or as fascist is counterproductive and cannot. They tried right after 2016 to make that, push that into the mainstream, and that failed. But they think they can and seem to be able to be successful if they position themselves as anti-communist.
Right.
And try to declare Antifa a communist group. So we're not.
But even then, someone has to be so sort of like, I guess, have a fucked up understanding of what communism is and other things to be like, yep, uh-huh, okay, I like this group.
It works. You saw in Portland last week that protester was shot in the back of the head by a tear gas canister.
Right.
Because you have part of their strategy.
Wait, but who shot that? Was that the police?
Yeah, the police shot a guy in the back of the head.
And that was a counter protester, right? Yeah, who had the, yeah.
That was a counter protester. And this is their strategy. You can read, Unicorn Riot has leaked thousands of chat logs between a lot of these people. It is their explicit strategy to be polite and nice to the police, because in part they depend on the police, because there's not that many of them.
Right.
And to try to get the police to fight Antifa. And that appears to be a successful strategy. And some of this is on the anti-fascist groups, because you will see a lot of fuck the police attitudes, a lot of rage at the police among these groups of counter-protesters, which I understand to an extent, but also is counterproductive on a tactical level.
Because it
brings the police in on the sides of the fascists. Mm-hmm. It's not... The wave of people who are at Unite the Right 2.0 are the fascists who have lost, because they went full Hitler too fast.
Right. Yeah.
The people who are dangerous now are the ones who are a little bit better at being cagey about it.
Yeah, we always say here at the Daily Zeitgeist, don't go full Hitler. Too fast.
Yeah, ease up on that Hitler throttle.
Right. You're saying that one of the counter-protesters jumped up when the Nazis were walking in with a flag and said... called them wankers.
He was a British guy.
Right.
An older British gentleman.
And grabbed their flag and then got, like, stomped out by Nazis and the police?
Yeah, he leapt over a line of police to grab this guy's flag and then hit the ground and then was kicked repeatedly by both the Nazi he'd grabbed a flag from and by the police around him, or at least a couple of the officers around him.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, there have been all sorts of studies that indicate that there are a lot of white supremacists or... you know, ideals like that in America's police force. So it's not totally shocking.
And increasingly becoming a bigger problem in the military too.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. About a quarter of active duty U.S. soldiers say they have met someone who has openly identified as a white nationalist while on duty.
Cool. Yeah. Well, what's something that's overrated, Robert?
I mean, margarine.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. It's time to stop big margarine.
Holy shit. Yeah. Now, shout out to my sponsors, Country Crock. I do not believe this.
Right.
But you go on, say your piece.
Well, I'm just going to say, if you just get some butter and you pour some honey in that butter and get a spoon, that's delicious. You make some honey butter, but if you stir honey into margarine and try to eat it with a spoon, you're going to be vomiting all
over
the place.
You're just eating vegetable oil. Also,
yes.
Is that true? You just eat honey and butter with a spoon?
Well, you stir it together, but honey butter...
That was the question.
usually I'll dip bread in it, but it's delicious. Yeah.
No, I mean, look, let me tell you something. I love butter. I remember as a kid, my parents had to regulate my, like, pad usage, mm-hmm. like a pad of butter at the restaurant, because I would take one pad and just put that on one bite of bread.
Yeah.
And they're like, hold on, you look crazy. You're making us look bad as parents.
Right.
But now in my adulthood, I'm just eating that. Nah, I guess I'm eating it with a spoon.
It's better sauce. It just makes it better. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Make it better with butter.
Salted butter or unsalted butter?
Different situations for
right.
both. Yeah.
See, yes, and that we were going to cover that, the great chef's debate about salted or unsalted butter.
Right.
And it really is contextual.
Unsalted is good as an ingredient.
As an ingredient, yes.
I personally prefer salted on for everyday use.
Yeah, I'll go on a nice run and just eat a stick of butter while I'm jogging.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You put it in like a power gel packet. It's like,
Can't do that with margarine.
Like, other than not being able to stir honey into it, are there, like, bad things about margarine? Is it worse for you or just equally bad for you?
I don't read about what's good for me.
He's more upset about the honey aspect.
Right.
Yeah.
What is something you think is underrated? Besides honey butter.
I think the danger of fascist activists is underrated because I think people look at the tiny numbers and people look at the fact that most Americans don't identify with them outright, and they don't look at the fact that, like, Laura Ingraham was on Fox News recently saying that immigration is changing the nature of America and we didn't vote for that shit. Like, the ideas that these people who are outright fascists have injected into the conversation has pulled everybody further to the right. And I think the threat of that is generally underrated at this moment.
Yeah. Yeah, but we're going to talk a little bit later about how there are all these, you know, Omarosa's has a recording of Trump and says there are recordings of him using the N-word. And, there are people who have worked at the White House who say that if you heard how Trump talked behind closed doors about black people and women, people would want to, like, burn the White House to the ground. But there are people saying, basically espousing the same ideology, just not saying the bad words, like on Fox News every fucking night. Tucker Carlson is openly a white supremacist now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And the Laura Ingraham thing, people do not accidentally make the Hail Hitler gesture
on a national stage. It's a hard one to accidentally make.
Yeah, she went full
Hail
Hitler.
She locked her arm.
Locked her arm.
Like, it wasn't a wave.
Yeah. She's like, no, that was my tennis elbow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is.
I stretch it out.
Full on Nazi.
I don't know when we can get enough of a boycott against their advertisers to fully form to actually put some kind of pressure. Because, like, we talked about it last week, that Laura Ingraham thing was wacky.
Yeah.
Like, they turned up white supremacy to 11 on that episode. And then the next day, that half-assed defense was just even worse. I don't like these shook Nazis who are like, yeah, I'm going to say this shit, but then when I get caught, I'm like, I don't know.
Well, right, because they're harder to defeat.
Yeah.
Because they just bend with you, you know?
All right, then. What do we do? I'm not buying Volvos anymore.
Right. Does Volvo still?
No, I don't think. I know they used to, but I'm curious to know who's even advertising on Pets.com.
Sleeping Giants was interviewed on one of the Cricket Media podcasts, and they were saying that they've only had like 3 advertisers who have just come back to them and been like, no, we're still going to advertise. We're good. So it's just like people who they haven't gotten to yet, apparently.
Yeah. I'm gonna watch closely because I just feel like Fox really does have to take some responsibility.
They need to be broken.
Yeah.
You need to be broken financially.
Yeah.
And I think that when you talk about Sleeping Giants, that's some of the most effective activism anyone in the country is doing right now.
Yeah.
I'm a big supporter of what they were doing.
And just for the listeners, they are doing what?
They are essentially, when people do stuff like what Laura Ingraham was doing, when they're outright racist or white supremacist or whatnot, they are contacting these people's advertisers and trying to get other people to contact the advertisers who advertise on these platforms and get them to pull their money, because that's how you hurt these people.
Yeah, it really hurt Breitbart over the past year and a half.
That's the funny thing about capitalism, is it's so easy to kneecap something because, you know, money's the fucking answer to everything in this fucking thing. So it's like, oh yeah, this... you just get rid of the advertising.
Right. And finally, Robert, what is a myth? What's something people think is true that you know to be false?
I think the idea that if a tape were to leak tomorrow where Donald Trump says the N-word, I think it's a myth that it would hurt him in any way, shape, or form. I don't think he loses a percentage point of his popularity from that. I think about 39 to 40% of the country is fine with using that word. They would not say they're fine with using that word as a description for all black people, but they'd probably bring you some variation of that old Chris Rock bit.
Right.
You
know?
Like, that's
a difference.
And I think about 40% of America honestly feels that
way. It would definitely depend on the context. Like, if
it's like Papa John's style.
Right. If it was Papa John's style, I'm sure he wouldn't lose too many points. But if it was, you know, like some of the things that have been reported that he has said in the past from people who heard it with their own ears, it's really dark. Like, he's a huge, like, dark racist. Like, not the type of racist that, you know, a soft racist is going to agree with. He's like a full-blown hardcore racist.
There's that guy who tweeted and whose tweet gets back into virality every now and then, who was like leading some sort of team onto a yacht that Trump owned, and Trump told him not to send one of his like mechanics or something, was a black guy. And Trump said he didn't want him on the boat. And they sued Trump over that.
Yeah.
And won. And like that's a thing that happened. Is Donald Trump didn't want a black man on his yacht.
Yeah. Or
because he's racist.
Or rent apartments to them.
Right.
Yep.
So it's just that's the other thing too, is I think the pressure has to be even harder on the Republicans and even fucking Democrats, man. Like, you need to also be just as vocal about this dude's bullshit. And I don't care if it hurts you because you're in a swing district. I mean, at some point, the game of becoming reelected and staying in office is keeping us from having like real unambiguous discussions about his behavior. Because if you're a vulnerable person up for reelection and you're a Democrat, you're not really going to go out there with your chest out about how the bullshit that the president is doing, because you got to worry about staying in office. And at some point, I think we need to demand that our leaders have a little bit more of a backbone.
Yeah.
On all sides. I mean, there's only a few Democrats who are consistently always coming out with, you know, the kind of commentary that's necessary.
Yeah. But I mean, politicians with no backbone learned their lesson from the Access Hollywood tape when, I mean, it was like full on. He's like, yeah, I'm a rapist. So that's what I'm about. And
And this is not a locker room.
Yeah. And people were still on board after that. And in fact, there was
focus
groups like Women for Trump launched the day after. So
yeah, politicians without backbones is a bit of a little redundant.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. All right, guys, let's get into the stories of the day. The Manafort defense has rested. They have dropped the mic. They were like, done and done. I think we've made our point.
I think it goes like this. The prosecution rests. Then the judge is like, okay, now what will the defense be presenting in case? We're good. It's
good. Yeah. So there's two weeks of prosecution calling witnesses who testified that Manafort did like all the money crimes, basically, and did them like flamboyantly, like he thought people couldn't see him, like he was invisible. And there were a couple weird like courtroom shenanigans that we don't totally understand just yet. Like there was a recess that was like a full day recess that nobody really knows why it happened.
A lot of behind closed doors meetings with the judge and defense and prosecution.
And then the defense requested that the case be dismissed, and the judge was like, no. But like there's a reason the defense thought that they could get away with that. And then apparently that was their whole idea, because then they were like, okay, now present your first witness. And they were like, we rest.
Nah, we're good.
Yeah. You'd present your first witness.
I don't
judge.
Know what's going to happen. If that means like, you know, a lot of the speculation has been some kind of issue with the jury, whether it was a juror overhearing something or speaking to someone, or if there is a, you know, a huge Donald Trump supporter who's just willing to stay locked in their position and have a hung jury.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like if it's a juror who overheard any of the news for the past 2 years, maybe he's anti-Manafort. Right. I don't know. It seems crazy that we have to have a trial where people would be completely impartial, but because of, you know, this touches literally every aspect of our country. Robert, you just did a Manafort episode of your podcast, Behind the Bastards. You did two Manafort episodes. So first of all, explain to our listeners what Behind the Bastards is for people who don't listen.
I mean, our tagline is we tell you everything you don't know about the very worst people in all of history.
Yeah.
And Paul Manafort is definitely one of those. What I say in the podcast and what I truly believe is that his work for Donald Trump is probably the least objectionable thing he's ever done.
That's crazy.
His whole career was built on, he's the guy who helped invent the modern concept of lobbying.
Yeah,
there were, I think, a couple of hundred lobbyists in the entire United States when Paul Manafort started his firm. And he is, like, you know how in the late 90s you started getting jokes on, like, The Simpsons about how, you know, all politicians are the same, Democrat and Republican, they're the same person, they support the same ideologies. A lot of that is due to the fact that the lobbying firm that Manafort started with Roger Stone and a guy whose last name was Black would regularly represent both sides of elections, because a big part of their goal was they would help. They were the first company to put lobbying under and like campaign advice and whatnot, campaign management under the same roof. So they would help both sides of an election in a contested district. And then no matter who won, they could then lobby to that person with whatever corporations were backing them.
Right. So they're at least partially responsible for everything bad that people hate about politics right now.
Yeah, within a decade of the establishment of Paul Manafort's firm, they went from a situation where there were maybe a couple of hundred lobbyists in the entire country to a situation where there were more than 10,000 lobbyists.
Yeah.
They have a lot to do with that.
Cool.
And Paul Manafort quickly stopped working in the U.S. as much and started working for a variety of dictators and terrorists all over the world. And that's who he spent most of his career representing. The name of the lobby that he invented was called the Torturers Lobby.
Right.
Like, that, he's that kind of guy.
Yeah. He's now, like, oh, yeah, you did human rights violations? Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to rehab your image.
Right.
You're going to put a suit on, and we'll present you to people in D.C., and they'll think you're a legit person.
Yeah.
Now, your show's also great for, you know, giving us weird personal details, like that Hitler was a fanboy of Westerns and that totally informed his, like, military decisions, and that Saddam was a romance novelist. Is there, like, a surprising personal detail about Manafort that you particularly liked?
Yeah. When he started working with Ukraine's wannabe dictator, Viktor Yanukovych, Yanukovych had just lost an election for president. It was Manafort who helped him get elected a few years later. And his advice to Yanukovych was to basically dress and act exactly like Paul Manafort. They got identical suits tailored together. He made Yanukovych start doing his hair the same way Manafort did. Like, that was how he helped this guy into power. It was like, be like me.
Yeah,
dress
right.
exactly like me.
You know what your problem is, Viktor? You don't have my swag.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what'll put you in it. Apparently worked.
Yeah.
Right.
For it's a while.
It's like twins.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. And so DEF CON, the top hacker conference took place over the weekend in Vegas.
Yeah.
And they demonstrated what they're capable of in terms of hacking.
There were a few highlights
that
we'll point out. There was first a group that hacked an Amazon Echo, and they were basically, they strung together like multiple bugs in like a second gen Echo that could basically allow a hacker to stream audio from a microphone remotely. So just kind of listening on you. But a lot of the DEF CON 2 is also meant for hackers to point out these vulnerabilities and then help these companies be like, hey, you need to sort this out.
Right.
So the group who had found this vulnerability, they've already told Amazon about it. So you don't have to full on worry about this and start putting your Echo inside of like a soundproof box or anything like that. It also requires pretty sophisticated access to like your Wi-Fi network. So I think you'll be all right. But it was just interesting enough to know, yeah, the thing that you thought can happen without them addressing that. And then last year, the DEF CON conference got a huge press buzz because they did a lot of work with voting machines.
Yeah.
And they showed how you could just hop in that thing and just mess with the vote tallies or whatever. And this year,
well, thank God they must have fixed that.
Yes,
like you
they
said.
Did. So they did. They totally worked that out. But except this year, they just upped the ante. And again, it was no different. They took a lot of the machines that a lot of states use when they're using electronic voting. They were able to upload their own malicious software. They could change vote tallies. And one of them even just pulled like the hot fire. What's that one gif with the dude just going with his hands on his cheeks like this? Ah! He had that gif just play on the screen because you can do anything.
Right.
But the real fun part about this one is they also had 40 children between the ages of 6 and 17 attempt to infiltrate replicas of these election board websites for several swing states. And so what they did was just built out like the exact architecture of these websites and just said, have at it, kids, if, you know, like young aspiring hackers, do your worst. And let's just say the kids are all right at hacking.
Right.
Because
and we are fucked.
They were able to, some of these kids were able to exploit vulnerabilities that they were able to tamper with vote tabulations, change the names of candidates. And one 11-year-old reportedly hacked into a mock-up of the Florida Secretary of State's website and changed the voting results within 10 minutes. But election officials were like, hey, I'm not really impressed by that.
I mean, yeah, most elections are done in, what, 4 or 5 minutes?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, the environment's completely different. Yeah, because a noisy conference hall is much different than the empty gymnasiums being overseen by octogenarians asking you, "When, where do you live?" If it's that easy for, you know, younger people with just sort of the basic skills to do it, I think maybe we should be looking into this a little bit more,
yeah.
rather than, you know, passing the blame and being like, oh, well, we're not really impressed by this.
It's scary because the details of this, like in some of the hacks, they changed the candidates' names, and like the things they changed it to were like Bob the Builder and right. Richard Nixon's head. So it's like a mixture of like juvenile sensibilities and, right. but they're like so
and Futurama easily references.
Able to just fucking, yeah, destroy this thing.
I follow a lot of these people on Twitter, a lot of folks who are at DEF CON, a lot of hackers, because I don't understand that at all. So I just try to listen to what the people who do say. And there was a big thread of people who do security for these things and who actually have been part of coding voting machines for like Diebold and stuff, saying, this is the only field of coders you will find this for. None of us think electronic voting is a good idea. None right. of the people responsible for securing electronic voting machines think that it's a good idea to vote electronically because right. they're just not secure.
Yeah, and you can't really point to hard evidence like a paper receipt or mm-hmm. something, or like, you know, how we have in California, like the inked up mm-hmm. Voting card we get. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. They also hacked police body cameras, voicemail.
The Internet of Things is horrifically insecure.
The body camera one was wild because they were, you know, people, hackers were able to like remotely download the footage, edit it, and then re-upload it, and they weren't, like, it was untraceable. Like, you wouldn't have known that someone had just switched out a video file in there.
Jesus.
So, that's cool. Hey, that's pretty cool.
Hey, man, that's cool.
Hey, so what else they do? Oh, they're able to live stream footage. So they're saying, you know, criminals could just basically tap into a feed and be like, oh, okay, that's where you are? Okay, that's pretty cool.
It's one of those things. It's weird because like in the 90s, it's sort of similar to what happened with gaming in the 90s, where there were all these pundits like screaming about how dangerous video games were, and it was bullshit. And so now when people try to point to like, no, there's actually some things we need to be concerned about psychologically of what like violent video games do to people, that doesn't get any traction because we were so used to, like,
it being bullshit.
It being bullshit. It's right. the same right. thing with hackers. We're so used to movies in 1998 where people were hacking cars and right. stuff. And it was like, that's not possible. But now it is.
Yeah, right.
Now
yeah.
we have autonomous cars.
Straight
and they
up.
Can be hacked.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Remotely started, remotely
yeah.
stopped.
Yeah.
Whatever
and,
you
and
need.
So our, like, our reflex to reject that as a possibility is out of sync with the reality
yeah,
of the situation.
100%. The voicemail one was really interesting, though, because I never thought of how that works. But so what they were saying is, like, you know, a lot of our mobile carriers, they were just terrible at securing voicemail because we're still using like 4-digit pins. Most people don't even know what their pin is because you can
right.
just dial it straight from your phone now.
Right.
And it's usually just the last four. It'll default to being the last 4 digits of your phone number.
Cool.
So yeah. So then basically what hackers can do, they can just brute force access your shit because there's also no limit of the number of like incorrect passwords you enter where it just locks it down.
Right.
So you can just have at it. And then once they do that, they can get into your voicemail system. They can request like WhatsApp send, like, you know, the target's code via a phone call. And if they don't pick it up and goes to voicemail, then they can access the voicemail, get the code, and then put your shit, like, you know, log into your PayPal, eBay, other shit just by using this like voicemail hack. So that's another cool, pretty cool thing that's going
yeah.
on.
Well, fortunately, we have our top minds at the top of the government just sort of
yes.
hold, locking everything down.
Yes.
As
artful.
Oh, but didn't they
just
actually
revealed.
Just pull a bunch of funding from that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, come on, Robert.
So Politico has a new article out that reveals that the president, you know, from past people who have left the White House and are not coming with the same energy as Omarosa, so they're just like dropping these anonymous hints or anonymous quotes to journalists. But the anonymous quotes are pretty scary. They say that the president doesn't seem to grasp the concept of time zones, because he always wants to call Abe, Japan's prime minister, in the middle of the night. He's like, yeah, let's give him a call at 3 in the afternoon. They're like, oh, but it's in the middle of the night where he is. And but he keeps bringing that up.
Yeah.
Like, he can't, it doesn't register.
Well, that's,
to him.
And again, that's a part where I'm almost like, okay, he could just be impulsive and
right.
he just wants when he wants it. Not that he has trouble understanding time zones, but he could also, it also shows there could be something wrong with his ability to retain information where someone
mm-hmm.
is saying, no, we can't call him because 11 at night there.
Right.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
Uh-huh.
Then 5 minutes later, you say the same shit.
And it's another example of like a thing. If he was just a guy, it wouldn't be, because there's a lot of people who don't really have a strong understanding of time zones. There's a
yeah,
lot of people
sure.
who can't pronounce Bhutan or Nepal. Like, there's a lot of people.
He called them nipple and button.
Yeah.
Like, legit, this is not a joke.
Yeah.
This is in the fucking article where he was, I think it was because he was prepping for a meeting with India, and he's like, what's this other shit here?
Yeah.
And they're like, that's.
He wasn't prepping for it. It was during the meeting with India.
Oh, and he's like, what's this other shit? He's like,
yeah.
The countries of Bhutan and Nepal. And he's like, nipple, button. Right. The fuck is that?
Nipple, button. But he didn't know it was a joke.
That'd be hard to button.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go on.
Rob. No, I was just saying, like, if he was a normal dude, this wouldn't be a problem. It'd be totally understandable, because there's a lot of shit to keep track of in the world for all of us.
And right.
You pick your battles. But he's the president.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
The president should know these things.
Yeah.
The stakes are much higher when you're the president for shit like reading, even.
One of my favorite details from the article is that, so during a meeting with Abe at Mar-a-Lago in April, he repeatedly praised Xi Jinping, according to this former NSC official, and everyone was cringing because Japan and China are rivals.
Yeah,
but presumably Trump was like, oh, another Asian guy. Yeah, I like the other one that I just met.
Hey, your cousin's pretty chill.
Right. And people were like, yo, that is, you're not supposed to talk about how much you love China to Japan. That's not a good look.
Why? What's that? It's called diplomacy, right. Asshole.
The Washington Post reported that he sometimes puts on an Indian accent and imitates the way their leader speaks. Well, real quick. So, like I said, on The Gist, Slate's daily podcast, a Republican strategist said that, you know, people who've worked at the White House say that if people heard how he talked about black people and women on a daily basis, they'd burn the place to the ground, was the direct quote. But one thing he does love doing is talking on the phone. He just calls leaders of foreign countries. He loves calling Macron from France and just like chatting. And Macron has to be like, hey, what are we talking about? Like, because he's very busy.
You know, I've got a country too, right?
You don't just like call to check in with someone and be like, hey, so what's up? And, you know, they try and get him to focus on like deliverables and like, you know, because he's the president,
right.
And the other leaders have, you know, things to do. So there needs to be some transaction, but he doesn't get that. And he just like hangs out like a, you know, 80s teenager.
He probably calls like, hey, I heard you guys won the World Cup. Who do you guys think in a football game, the Eagles or the French national team? Come on down to the gridiron. Let's see what's up. He's like, I'm sorry, what is this call about?
Right.
I don't know. I'm lonely.
There's a joke with Japanese diplomats that Abe has had one meeting with Trump 7 times because he has to go back over the same issues every time he talks to him.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So.
And then I like how the arc that goes on. Abe and his aides have avoided telling Trump that he contacts them too often for fear of harming their friendly relationship. Oh, Japan.
They're just not that into you, Donald.
Well, yeah, but it's so Japanese, too, where even, like, you're doing high-stakes governmental business, and it was just more like, I get it for diplomacy, too, but I can also see how, just being Japanese, too, it's like, let's not call out his shit to his face, too, because it's,
yeah. You don't want to rock. I mean, despite how he acts, he's still the most powerful person on the planet, so, yeah.
This you don't want to call 7 times.
Yeah.
It's just probably about, hey, how's your cousin doing? You think he'll knock the tariffs off?
Right, right.
Did you talk to him? Are you having dinner or something soon?
What's she up to? Bob Goodlatte. Let's talk about this dude.
Oh, Bob Goodlatte. I mean, look, it's just a quick story because he is, you know, he's a Freedom Caucus hack. He loves to grandstand for anything super right, like Benghazi. He was all about it in the Russia. Like a Russia hearings, he's been grandstanding. This is just his vibe. He's just one of those repulsive Freedom Caucus Republicans who is all about protecting the president and disregarding fact or honesty or having things like pride or shame, things like that. But his son is out here on Twitter just getting messy. You know, his son, Bobby Goodlatte, he tweeted, he just tweeted, quote, I just gave the maximum allowed donation to Jennifer Lewis, a Democrat running for my father's congressional seat. I've also gotten 5 other folks to commit to donate the max. 2018 is a year to flip districts. Let's do this. So he's basically saying, I'm giving money to somebody to get my dad the fuck out of Congress. And that tweet went buku, because I mean, Bob Goodlatte is just one of the most unsavory characters in the house.
And I do love this new trend, because it happened with Stephen Miller too.
Yeah,
people's relatives, like, throwing them under the bus for being monsters.
Yeah. I think it's probably good, because in the future you'll be like, wait, you're Bobby Goodlatte? You're like, but the tweet though, you saw the tweet?
Right.
Oh yeah, all right, gang. Yeah,
I did my part.
Yeah. Hey, I maxed out.
Yeah.
I maxed out to Jennifer Lewis's campaign. You think I may be his son. I may be Bobby Goodlatte Jr., but I maxed out to his thing.
I'm doing my best.
Yeah, I think it must be tough, though, when you have these familial relationships to these people who are so, like, you have the same name or whatever.
I'm related to Rick Santorum.
No.
Yeah.
You
it's
are?
A distant family relation. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And he's a real piece of shit.
Yeah.
Hey, come on. I mean, we can't say that.
He's a real piece of Santorum.
Yeah, there you go.
There we go.
Which is
brought to you by Santorum Subs.
Foam that is created...
when you're having anal sex and the poop and the cum all get sort of, that's Santorum, as I understand
foam
it.
Up that yeah. is
wow mm-hmm. yeah. Welcome to our new show.
Mm-hmm. No, that's what a Santorum, they made that because he was such an asshole to the
they made what do you who made that
like
the
gay community
made that
yeah, oh, like
made that their
thing.
Term
yeah.
for that foam
wow
yeah.
Just to make sure he is not forgotten.
He lives in infamy.
Yeah. He will be remembered.
But I mean, to Bobby Goodlatte's credit, you know, Donald Trump Jr. Supposedly hated his dad like his whole life and was, you know, kind of abused by him and was just like, this guy's the fucking worst. But when it became, you know, politically and socially a good thing for him to, you know, say that he fucked with his dad, he did that because, you know,
when you
he's
say fucked with him, he's like he bangs with him.
Yeah, yeah. Like, he's cool with his dad now.
I mean, oddly enough, he could be the one who brings it all fucking down, because he's the one who, from what we see, seems like to have had the most direct contact with Russia repeatedly. Which would be a fitting end.
All right, Robert, I wanted to check in with you on just what's going on internationally. You're someone who has been on top of shit that, like, we're talking about it today in the news, but you were on top of it years ago when it was first, like, popping off, like the Crimea Revolution is a big issue in U.S.-Russia relations today. And you wrote an article about that, like, as it was happening when we worked together back at Cracked. You were, like, on top of it and, like, interacting with the rebels, like, when that was first popping off.
Yeah. And that was my first, like, real piece of journalism was interviewing a bunch of protesters at the Maidan. And in general, what I'll say is, if things go badly in the next couple of years, like, really, really badly, like global conflict, you know, expanding to a size we haven't seen in decades badly, I think historians in the future might trace back the starting of whatever hostilities erupt as far back as 2007. Like, when we're looking at, like, now, like, we look at World War II and you're like, when does it start? And a lot of people say 1938, you know,
right.
As opposed to, you know, 1939 or 40. I think they might trace this global conflict that I do believe we are in a global conflict right now. And I think the war fighting domain that it has mainly occurred in is the internet, but it has physical battlefields in Ukraine, in Syria, in Iraq, in other countries around the world. And I think we may trace the beginning of that conflict back to 2007, when Russia launched an unprecedented cyber attack against Estonia, which was at that point, and I think it's still at this point, the most wired nation on the planet. All of their banking, their voting, all of their government work was essentially carried out online. So it was a devastating attack that was launched on them.
Their system is actually really cool. Like, when you read about how Estonia is set up, like, it's all this really intuitive stuff that it's like, oh yeah, that is how the internet should have simplified our life. But because we are sort of this corporatocracy, all the different ways that corporatocracies are inefficient have made it so that we're not able to take advantage of that. But read up on Estonia. They really do a cool thing.
And they are, the whole country right now is ready and is in a semi-permanent state of being ready for a mass national war with Russia.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, of course, in 2008, we had a war between Russia and Georgia. And some people will say it only lasted like 5 days. And some people will say, and in fact, the UN has said that the actual fighting started when Georgian troops started firing on separatist troops that then brought the Russians in. But leading up to it, there was an internet blitz, there was a propaganda blitz, there was a, you know, arming of these sort of breakaway groups by the Russians. So it's very complicated. But it's, you can almost look at what happened in Georgia and what happened in Estonia as a lead up to what happened in Ukraine. Because after, in 2014, basically a bunch of protesters rose up against the government of Viktor Yanukovych, who was the president of Ukraine and had brutally suppressed with extreme violence protests in the center of the city that led to a larger protest movement geared at unseating him.
And he was pro-Russian?
He was very pro-Russian. He wanted to pull the country out of a deal that it had made that would bring it closer to the EU in favor of going closer to Russia, which most Ukrainians supported getting closer to the EU, except for in the east. And when I went over, I've spent a lot of time in eastern Ukraine talking to people who supported the separatists at first and talking to people who lived in those areas because a civil war started after that. Like after these protesters in western Ukraine unseated the president, the civil war began in eastern Ukraine. And that civil war was largely, there were some local rebels who started the fighting, but a lot of the first wave and a lot of the current fighters there are Russian soldiers who just pulled off their uniform patches and crossed the border. Their artillery is Russian, their tanks are Russian.
So the guys that you were kind of interacting with, the men and women, I guess, the reason that we started writing about it at Cracked is like it was just this incredible scene of like they built a snow fort.
Yeah,
in
an
the
ice fortress.
This
is the Maidan protest in the West.
In the middle of the city, and you know, we're fighting their government with catapults and like burning tires out of an ice fortress.
Yeah.
It was just this crazy story.
And Paul Manafort was behind a lot of that, and was apparently, according to Paul Manafort's daughters, he was the one who urged the Ukrainian government to crack down violently on the protesters.
Mm-hmm. He has so much blood on his hands.
And if you talk to Ukrainians about what they saw as the lead up to that, starting a year or two before hostilities started, there was a propaganda blitz in Russian media aimed at creating a divide between Western and Eastern Ukraine, much as there was a propaganda blitz in the United States aimed at creating a divide between the left and the right. Or not creating, but further widening. Because there was a divide between East and Western Ukraine.
Well, their first attempt was Texas and California secession.
Yeah,
and they were like, wait, this isn't catching on like other places.
So the right and the left certainly hate each other.
I think my point is that you number one, and this is something the Defense Department came out last year in a report and said that the United States has fallen behind in the internet as a warfighting domain. And it is a very important warfighting domain. And if you look at it that way, this conflict has been going on for a decade now.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to connect. So number one, a lot of the fighters who provided manpower for the civil war in Ukraine were essentially propagandized on the internet. There's a video called I, Russian Occupier that was viewed millions of times. And I've talked to at least one pro-Russian insurgent who fought on the side of the Russian-backed separatists who was radicalized by this video. And it used a lot of video game imagery. And it seems very similar to a video called The Lion of Europe that's about Hitler that I've noticed a number of right-wing and fascist activists in the United States point to as like a video that radicalized them. They use the same, they're set up almost as movie trailers. And they use a lot of like video game style imagery. And it's, I get to this point where I'm like, okay, am I just, because I spend so much time thinking on this, am I like, have I gone crazy? Like, am I building this up to be more than it is? But I do think there's a global conflict and people, social media has a death count, a substantial death count, because there were, you know, thousands of soldiers in Ukraine who were reached out to and radicalized through the internet and wound up fighting there because they were convinced to leave their homes and go fight there because of stuff they saw on the internet. And the same thing is true in Syria and Iraq, 20 to 30,000 soldiers who were radicalized online through Twitter, through Facebook, through YouTube.
Yeah. It's like in the past, in traditional warfare, you would go invade and then try to win hearts and minds. And now you start out with the hearts and minds and try and like win people over to your cause and then radicalize them, I guess.
Yeah. And so that's like, I would say in terms of where I'm looking at right now, I think there's a possibility that we're going to see more violent conflict between the Syrian government now that the civil war is winding down and the Turkish government. And I don't know where the U.S. is going to fall on that or where Russia is going to fall on that, because both the U.S. and Russia have, you know, the U.S. has supported the Kurds in Syria, who are now allied pretty closely and increasingly closely with the Syrian government. The Russians have supported the Syrian government, but the U.S. and Russia have both also supported and sold arms to the Turkish government.
Right.
So it's really hard to see what's going to happen there.
But just generally, I mean, we've talked on this show, super producer Nick Stumpf was talking about how, you know, there's this idea that we're no longer in a place where we can understand conflicts regionally, mm-hmm. and it's more, you know, because the internet has just kind of broken down those barriers, it's just ideological conflicts that spread that aren't based on where you live, but they're just, you know, being fought across the world on the internet.
And the actual military power of a state, at least at this point in whatever conflict is going on, matters a lot less than their ability to project power through the internet. Because the Russian military on paper is very weak.
Right.
They are not on paper a threat to the United States or to NATO.
Right.
They've got this tank called the Armada that was, there are a bunch of viral stories 4 or 5 years back about it, about how much deadlier it is than all of NATO's tanks. And the undercovered postscript of that is that Russia's ordered less than 100 of them and has cut back on their orders substantially. And it's cost them something like $1 trillion. It's their equivalent of the F-35. It's
right.
a big boondoggle that's expensive and not effective. The Russian military is not effective, would not be an effective warfighting force in the conventional sense. But it's been very effective in Syria. It's been very effective in Ukraine because they have married the use of fairly small surgical amounts of force to the use of very successful propaganda and media campaigns.
Right.
And couple that with like some insurgency mm-hmm. movement, and you're like, boom.
Yeah, and the U.S. is bad at that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because it used to be like, you know, like rain down pamphlets of propaganda by air back in the
right.
old days.
That was the best we had.
Yeah, that was like, that was Twitter back then.
Right,
and exactly. now it's just straight up, no, you got it on your phone.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that was very interesting. Thank you for that. We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back. And we're back. And
we are.
I was almost surprised that we were back in that delivery of that.
Yeah.
So speaking of surprises, guys, the Meg.
What is the Meg exactly? I mean, I know it's a movie. What is it about?
It's about a
big ass shark.
An extinct species of shark that was like basically a giant great white, except more deadly and like more angry and better at killing. It's called the Megalodon is the full name for it. And if you were obsessed with sharks, like I was when I was a kid, it's like, you know, just this mythical creature that's like
in terms
so
of
cool.
scale, it's like to a great white shark what a great white shark is to a salmon.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's tight. Wait, this already happened. There was like mega shark versus giant octopus.
There's been a lot of movies
mega
about
shark versus crocosaurus.
So, I'm trying to like puzzle through this because so I pay attention to the box office. They're usually like on Friday they will put out their box office prediction, like these box office analysts, and they'll usually be between like 5% and 10%. Like sometimes they're just like right on point being able to predict exactly what something's gonna make. The Meg came out this weekend, it doubled what Box Office Mojo was predicting.
Holy shit.
It pulled in $146.9 million globally. Nobody really
saw that.
Is that
more than Solo got?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It destroyed Solo. It's it might be more than Solo's made.
Fucking Disney.
Yeah. But so I'm trying to figure out like what about this connected so much with people. I'm thinking there's something about so there's been shark movies since Jaws. There's Deep Blue Sea. There are shittier shark movies like Sharknado and stuff like that. But I wonder if there's something to it being a singular, like there's been sharks movies, like where there are multiple sharks, but not a like singular shark movie. And I think there's like something about one giant man-eating shark that makes, I don't know, that appeals to us a little bit more.
I also know, I mean, Jack, you and I have been making content for people on the internet for a very long time, and we've noticed that it's definitely cyclical what people are interested in.
Yeah.
And when we were both at Cracked, in the early years of Cracked, some of our most successful articles were lists of weird prehistoric animals and monsters and insects that were scary. And then for years, you couldn't get people to read that stuff, and maybe it's just that that shit swung back around and people are interested again.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely true. I think people have always been interested in big prehistoric creatures. I think what happened at Cracked was that we created a type of article that we were the only ones doing it, and then BuzzFeed and a bunch of other websites like basically saw that those articles were popular.
Listicle.
And yeah, the listicle.
Listicle.
Well, and they like flooded the internet with articles that were indistinguishable from ours. They weren't quite as good as ours, but they were like easy to confuse with it. And when you're on the internet, you can't tell the difference.
So I can blame y'all for these 15 teen celebs have taken a turn for the worse.
No, it's still BuzzFeed's fault.
Number
that
six will make you die.
Shout out a terrible version. But to your point about like the cyclical nature of things, one thing we did notice in the early days, and I think up until the end at Cracked, was that robots were no longer scary to people. In the 80s, they were like a thing that the whole world was terrified of, and there were all these movie franchises. And
shout out to Batteries Not Included.
Yeah, and then like starting in about 2008, 2009, we just like couldn't get people to read about robots in any way.
Yeah,
unless it was like, this robot's fucking cool and does a thing that's going to solve a problem that you have.
We had at least exactly one article about drones that got decent traffic, and then no one wanted to read about Drone War anymore.
Right, like, yeah, that's right.
I wonder if some of it might also be, though, like right now you've got a bunch of it's a very political time in the country, and you've got a lot of very political movies, Black KK Klansmen, or however we're supposed to pronounce it.
Just Klansmen.
Sorry to Bother You. And like a lot of political stuff that's dropped recently, and maybe people were like, oh, it's just a movie about a big ass shark. That seems like it'll be
turn
a
my
palate cleanser. I just don't want to think about the fucked up state of the world.
That is what it is. It's so broad.
Yeah.
And
completely
it's basically shark. It distills Shark Week's, the energy of Shark Week, and puts it into a movie that like they also engineered to be accessible to China and America. And I think because
it put up 46 million in America, it put up 50 million in China.
Right.
That rarely happens.
Because, you know, really when you get that on screen duo of Jason Statham and Li Bingbing. I mean, you know, that's just money in the register, bling, bling. But with these two, I think it's just because it's so, it's just easy to understand. Big ass shark, motherfuckers are scared.
100% of humans can understand the appeal of that. It's not like Star Wars, where there's a lot of cultural things as to whether or not you find that story interesting. It's just, oh, yeah, big shark attacking people. I'm scared of sharks.
Right.
I've swam.
And I think, because like The Shallows or 47 Meters Down, those are a little more nuanced for shark films.
And there are multiple sharks. I'm telling you, that has something to do with it.
Well, no, The Shallows was just one, right?
Oh, was it?
It was just that lady who goes out swimming and gets the shit bitten out of her. And that was a pretty fun. I enjoyed that.
They're intense. But I think with this one, you can just look at a shot where like one shark is the size of like 900 people and you're like,
Yeah, that shot in the trailer of like there's a bunch of people swimming and you see the shark's mouth in the water and it's like, as big as all. And you're like, oh, okay, I want to see a shark
all
eat
of that
a bunch of people.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a Roland Emmerich movie, but with a shark. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I was overthinking it, and it's just like, it's a Roland Emmerich movie with a giant shark.
Well, I guess that's how much we're dumbing things down, where we're like, surely people's tastes have to be a little more refined than such an aggressively beef movie or whatever, but at the end of the day, you just want to see some motherfuckers get eaten by sharks.
Super producer Anna Hosnier is writing a question to me, Team Field Trip, which... Yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
Bring a Sprig Soda.
To go hunt down the megalodon that lives in the Marianas Trench, right?
That's
what you're suggesting. But we hijack James Cameron's submarine and ride it down there with a bunch of shotguns and take out that damn fish.
Hell yeah. Or why don't we just get Meg tattoos?
But or that.
Either or.
I thought that's what she meant by Team Field.
Yeah.
Go get Meg tattoos.
Yeah, we'll get Meg tattoos. I'm just get a big shark on my throat.
But I mean the first Jaws is a B movie executed by like a Hitchcockian great director, and the first Jurassic Park, I'd say the same thing. And even though the first Jurassic Park has the raptors, it still has this like the T-Rex is like the singular monster that's like lurking out there that you're constantly aware of. It's not just like a bunch of different animals.
Have you seen what the projections are for this weekend? They think it's going to double.
They think the Meg is going to double?
I can see that because it's a surprise.
Internationally,
when something is a surprise, people start piling on.
Another thing in one of these articles I'm reading that an analyst did point out was sort of like it comes at the right time where all the traditional tentpole movies in the summer have already happened. People are right about to go to school. So you get your last hurrah in. And it's like nothing too weird. Like you now really have to wrap your head around it. So they're kind of found like a good lull.
I think Crazy Rich Asians is going to do well this weekend too.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, I think so.
I hope that next year is 50% movies about sharks and 50% movies with Ken Jeong. as a, yeah, as a major right. character.
And it could be that sharks just kind of are a great metaphor for the time we live in now, where like we're innocent people and there are just a few disgusting sharks out there wanting to do the
right.
most.
Yeah, I mean, the shark clearly represents Donald Trump. I didn't say it.
I meant Spectrum Cable.
Oh, okay.
Because they do not. I got words for them.
All right, it's time for beverage update. Two beverage-related stories. For some reason, they just happened to come across the transom at the same time. Miles, let's talk about the old "Can I get a cup for water?" scam.
Okay, I don't know about y'all, but when you're in high school, this is standard operating procedure. When you have no money, but you want a little bit of a soda at a fast food restaurant, you go up there,
taste of something sweet,
and you say, "Can I get a cup for water, please?" Mm-hmm. And they give you the plastic see-through cup because they right. want to make sure. So this is a tale about a man who took this a little too far. So this 48-year-old man, Daniel Stein, in Montana, he pulled the same trick at an Arby's. An employee saw that he just went for the sweet, sweet soda, confronted him. He ran out. And then as he kept confronting him, the man who is the perpetrator started like attacking him, tried to kick at him. So the boy was just like, "All right, fuck this." Called the cops.
World's most dedicated Arby's employee, I know. By the way. Like, come on, Liam Neeson, settle the fuck down. That's just a goddamn.
I'm going to go on a limb and say that was not a person of color who was working at Arby's. Because you'd be like, "Yeah, what, get the fuck out of here." Right. Anyway, excuse me, sir. You have lemonade in there. So the cops show up. This dude, Dan Stein, he ran into a Denny's, hid in the bathroom. He wouldn't come out. The officers tried to get him out. They had to physically try and open the door. He started resisting, started fighting with officers. He had to be tased. And now my man is looking at so many charges: felony robbery, then four misdemeanors, criminal trespass, disorderly conduct, obstructing a peace officer, and resisting arrest.
What is the felony robbery?
All because you wanted to save a couple pennies.
Wait, the felony robbery is just putting soda inside the water cup?
I don't know
if you steal anything and then commit a violent crime, it can be bumped up to a felony.
Yeah.
And assaulting an officer is a very broad term.
Oh, yeah. You can just be like, "Hey, don't touch me."
An officer, covering protests, I've been shoved by a lot of police officers. And if you shove back, that's assaulting an officer.
Your head will be cracked.
Yeah.
That's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then in other beverage news.
I just like that.
This
news story. Yes.
This is a bummer.
This is more of a hack. And I saw this. You guys see this? This was going around. This was going around. It's like from an old article, but suddenly like a lot of people started writing it up again. So we find out that there's a thing flight attendants do not do. There's one thing that a lot of flight attendants, they just know better when you're on a flight. You do not do this one thing. And that is to drink straight up coffee or tea on an airplane, or drink any of the fucking tap water on a plane, because it is disgusting.
Right. So this is anything that does not come
in a bottle.
A bottle or a can that is like where you can see that the seal has been broken.
Mm-hmm.
Like doctors even say, don't fill up a water bottle for a baby. Like, now we're not talking about like in the sink in the bathroom. Obviously, you don't use that. But like even the drinking water that the flight attendants carry around.
Yeah. So they say, or if you're immunocompromised, don't.
Right.
Because there was a study, this was like 14 years ago, but still, I think it still holds true. I think they refer to some other more relevant stuff too. But they said in a sample of 158 planes, 13% contained coliform. Two of the airplanes are found to have dangerous E. coli in the water. And then another thing they say, the EPA study found that one in every eight planes fails the agency's standards for water safety. Now, keep in mind, the EPA is the government body that they look over and they make sure the standards for plain water is in their purview. So considering where the EPA is right now, I would probably worry even more whatever the fuck is in there, because I don't think anybody's going to be checking now.
I say roll the dice. Don't be a wuss. Roll the dice. Drink the water.
Drink the diarrhea water.
Drink as much as they will give you, and you will be stronger. It's the same reason I suggest licking the floor of bathrooms when you're at the bar. It just makes you stronger.
That's what my mom used to do when I was a kid.
We cannot recommend Robert's advice on this. Robert also likes to make drugs that haven't been taken by humans in 100 years. He has a whole book about that. So
I'm just saying, when society collapses, those of us who have been drinking the filthy airplane coffee will be the ones who rebuild the world.
I mean, anybody who I think was a dirty little kid and got just shit all over you, like dirt in your, just eating garbage or whatever,
right?
Like I used to. Mm-hmm. You got that good diversity, hopefully, in your immune system.
Yeah,
that's strong constitution.
It's It's like Danny DeVito. That's why he's unkillable. I assume that he is the same as he is in Always Sunny. And
he's like, my secret. I'm just
plugging up
bathrooms.
Wounds with trash.
Yeah. Second Danny DeVito ref in the
yeah,
same show.
Yeah, damn.
One of the better myths that I've had busted for me is for some reason, I always assumed planes were, and we've talked about this before, but in case you didn't hear that episode, I always assumed that it was the air being like spit back at us through the air filters in planes, that like the air was full of germs. And it's just that every surface in an airplane, like they don't get cleaned ever.
No,
like,
have you seen how quickly they clean a plane?
Yeah, they go in for like 5 minutes.
They just pull shit out of the pockets.
Yeah. So it's like sitting in a, you know, public restroom, literally. Like you're sitting in a bar restroom and you're putting your face down on it and you're, you know, it's really bad for you. So like the first, if you want to avoid germs, if you
just
don't.
Just wear a biohazard suit.
Right. But no, just like. Fly. Wipe down your seat. Wipe down everything around you. That's one of the best things you can
do. Or you do, I do. I buy a plane outfit.
Right.
Which is a really cheap
hazmat suit.
Just t-shirt and pants from a thrift store. And I throw it away upon landing at my
do
destination.
Really?
Don't want to wear it. No, of course not.
I'm publicly wearing, as yeah, I walk off the plane.
I'm wearing an oversized Tweety Bird shirt and like weird sweatpants. I'm like, what the fuck is it?
That would explain a lot about how people dress on planes.
Yeah, I'm sure there are people who are that concerned about their germs who have like throwaway clothes.
Yeah. Robert, it's been a lot of fun having you, man.
Thank you.
Where can people find you, follow you online?
Well, they can find my podcast, Behind the Bastards. We just had another episode drop on Tuesday, and we'll have another one coming out on Thursday. It's a two-part series on Charles Koch, the Luke Skywalker of rich people. So I recommend checking that out.
You the Luke Skywalker of rich people.
Yeah,
I like that.
That's how he views himself.
And his dad was a Nazi.
Yeah, his dad built a critical piece of infrastructure for the Nazis.
Right.
And also said that the Nazis were the people who had the best culture in the world in 1938.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so. he was raised by a Nazi nanny.
Yes, who measured his poop every morning.
Right.
Yep.
And literal Nazi went and was like, hey, I've loved being your nanny, but this Nazi thing's popping off over during World War II. I'm going to go back to Germany.
She left in 1940 to celebrate the victory over France with Hitler.
Right. Yeah,
that's tight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like Luke Skywalker, I also heard his Uncle Ben and Aunt Beru were tragically killed.
Yes.
He was on his
and
way.
That I'm not going to make fun of him for that.
Yeah,
that's horrible.
And, you know, I think Charles Koch's dream was just to go to Tashi Station for some power converters.
Yeah, so. That's what all of us want.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can also find me on Twitter at IWriteOkay, and you can find my book that Jack mentioned on Amazon, A Brief History of Vice. So that's where you can find me.
Yep. And also, do you have a tweet you've been enjoying?
Yes. It's the guy who did the tweet about a genie, and he asked the genie to, the genie said he had two wishes, and his first wish was to replace every G with a P, and his second wish was to replace an E at the end of every word with an S, and so the genie's name was Penis by the end of the joke. it was a great Twitter gag.
That is awesome. Miles, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Miles of Gray. And, you know, shout out to Christy Yamaguchi Mame, who, through some Reddit sleuthing, I figured out that there is a Daily Zeitgeist subreddit that they be running. So shout out to the Daily Zeitgeist subreddit where you guys talk about the show. I see you out there. I'm stalking you on Twitter. And in terms of a tweet that I'm feeling, comes from Lexi Alexander, she wrote a tweet that said, "Shout out to white male critics who have trouble connecting to crazy rich Asians and black Klansmen. Does it not speak to your experience? What's that like? I'm so lucky to have all these movies featuring multicultural feminists or Arabs in creative industries like myself. I can't imagine."
All right. And a tweet I was enjoying from Omar Najam. It starts out, "Teacher sees student sharing a note. Teacher, why don't you read that out loud? Student, reading note. Dear teacher, this is an intervention. Your methods of discipline via public humiliation are uninspired carbon copies of Hollywood tropes. We wrote this letter as a class." And you can follow me on Twitter at Jack_O'Brien. You can follow us on Twitter at Daily Zeitgeist. We're at The Daily Zeitgeist on Instagram. We have a Facebook fan page and a website, dailyzeitgeist.com. You can find footnotes for this episode in the description of the episode, as well as on our website. Footnotes are where we link off to the information that we talked about. Source that shit. And we also link off to the song that we ride out on. Miles, What's that going to be?
What is that going to be? I think I want to play a Raven Lynae song. Now, I know during 420 week, I played a track from her that was called Sticky that was produced by Stephen Lacey that had like a very sort of new R&B vibe to it. This is a track called Sleep Talking. The production is much more, you know, beady. I got that little bit of sort of fly low extra percussion in the background. But this is Sleep Talking by Raven Lynae.
All right, we're going to ride out on that. We will be back tomorrow because it is a daily podcast. Talk to you guys then.
Bye.
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 Intertwined, we never seem to find the right things to say. When we are awake, I cannot close your eyes. TV up so high, as if we're trying to hide the things we'll never find out. Wish you would say that we'll be okay. Our stomach's not in us no more. Or maybe I'm not everything you got no more. You still listen to your heartbeat while you're dreaming softly. I wish you would have told me that you do not know me. I wish you would have spoke before our fingers broke. 10:30 p.m. Your dreaming begins with no worries and stories of life way back when your sister would kiss you and tell you she missed you. I'm sorry that that had to end. 11:30, you're speaking slowly, you say you're lonely, you say you wish that you could hold me. If I would not pretend that I needed him. 12:10, if we would not pretend that we could be friends. 1:11, if you would not extend your beautiful hand to touch me. 1:30, you're so, so lucky that I do not trust me. You only speak with your hands. So tell me, how do I understand? How do I understand? But can, can.